Today's sponsor is Datadog, a monitoring and analytics platform for cloud-scale infrastructure and applications. Datadog provides seamless integrations with more than 400 technologies, including AWS, PostgreSQL, MySQL, Docker, so you can start collecting and visualizing performance metrics quickly. Distributed tracing and APM give you end-to-end visibility into requests wherever they go, across hosts, across containers, across service boundaries. With rich dashboards, algorithmic alerts, and collaboration tools, Datadog will give your team the tools they need to quickly troubleshoot and optimize modern applications. See for yourself. Start a 14-day free trial today by visiting datadoghq.com/Hanselminutes, and they'll send you a free t-shirt. That's datadoghq.com/Hanselminutes. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking to Laurent Gray, who's on the Azure Red team at Microsoft. How are you, sir?
I'm doing all right. Yeah, doing pretty well.
So, Red team, what is that?
So, the Red team is, or a Red team in general, is a team that performs adversary emulation. So, our job is to pretend to be the bad guys and to hack all your stuff.
Seriously? Like adversary emulation. That is a pretty awesome way to phrase it.
That's like the official, like formal terminology for it. Mm-hmm. Mostly people are just like, oh yeah, you're hackers. And they kind of just put everybody in the same bubble. Mm-hmm. But red teaming is like a very specific form of it. Right. So you have like, you know, pen testers and you have red teamers and vulnerability assessors, and everyone does a really different job, but our job is to pretend to be act as real attackers.
Is there a blue team? I've heard that term as well.
Yeah. So the blue team are our counterparts, and they're the ones defending, right? So their job is to be able to detect and evict red teamers, or even sometimes, you know, real attackers.
Okay. So hang on. You're the adversary emulator. You are pretending to be evil. You're the red team. The blue team is like maybe sitting in the same building and they're on the other side trying to keep you out?
Figuratively speaking, yeah. They're on the
figuratively speaking. Yeah. Everything we're saying is figuratively speaking. I don't mean they're like legitimately in the next cubicle over, but like from a boxes and lines perspective, do you all have lunch together? Do you even know who they are? Like the teams, are they separated and hidden from each other?
So at Microsoft, there's a bunch of red teams and there's a bunch of blue teams. Mm-hmm. And not everybody, you may not know who everybody is, right? So if we're performing an operation against one service, right, they may have a specific blue team that they need to go to in order to resolve issues. Mm. It may not be the same blue team as another service from a different organization. So like they have to know who their blue teams are, but we as the Azure Red Team have like this oversight or scope rather, like all of all of Azure. Mm-hmm. So we come across different blue teams.
So if I were going to make a thing, let's say I was going to make a new service, like, I don't know, Scott as a service, and it's going to be, and I proposed to the bosses and I've done all this kind of stuff and we've done the work and we're going to put it live in Azure and we're going to start doing that. I assume that there's a series of security checkpoints that one has to go through, and surviving regular multiple red team attacks seems like a thing that I would put on my checklist.
Yeah, for sure. There's definitely like a security assurance kind of deal that happens. Mm-hmm. But I'm not really knowledgeable about that aspect of it.
Sure. But your job is to basically win, I suppose. Is the red team's job to say, hey, we tried as hard as we could and we couldn't get in? Or is it more successful to say, hey, we got in and here's how we mitigate that?
Either's fine, right? So a red team is, or offensive security in general, the point isn't to like be successful all the time. Like being successful feels good, but the whole point is to assess the like security posture. So if we can't get in and you like, we are being stopped and blocked completely, it's a good thing overall for security. It may hurt our feelings, but like our feelings don't matter in the overall scheme of making sure things are secure.
And is it, you said operations, that term operations is interesting because it implies like kind of a finite, like you're not just sitting around thinking of crazy stuff that you can do to break into a system. You might be saying, hey, we're going to focus on, you know, service A or project B right now. And for the next month, we're going to go through this list to try to deal with this. You are kind of like hired as mercenaries, effectively digital mercenaries, to like in the movies when someone says, "Hey, can you break into my safe? Here, I'll, you know, here's the parameters. You have 3 days to get into my safe."
It's kind of both. Like we'll do like our regular operations against a specific service, mm-hmm. and that's how our operations are broken out into. Mm. But at the same time, we're always trying to come up with new techniques for things, right? To try something that we may not have seen before, but we kind of assume that, and the general assumption is that if you can do it, then somebody else can do it, mm. or somebody else might have thought of it first. If you have that mindset, then anything like any new technique that we create, we just assume that somebody else has done it before, and we go to verify that mm-hmm. it's not like a systemic issue and that no one else has been affected by this. So it's kind of both. Like we will do our normal operations against a service, but at the same time, we're trying to find new tactics that our team may not have seen or may not have been, you know, detected by the blue teams, or, you know, the security operation centers, and say, you know, has this been done before?
So I understand that there's all kinds of kits that one can download. Like I might have a WordPress site or a blog or whatever, some custom CMS. There's all kinds of like Swiss Army knife security things that I can say, hey, go attack that. And it kind of runs through the obvious stuff. Are those tools that you use? Do you use the obvious things just to make sure nothing's regressed or gone backwards?
So our team is a little bit different. Yeah. So in general, like for red teaming, there are a lot of tools that you can use, a lot of C2 systems, which is like, you know, you have a server and then you have like an agent on someone's computer and then you're interacting with their computer that, you know, that you've hacked, quote. But our team is a little bit different in Azure, and that's because a significant portion of enterprises or even like security professionals are just learning Azure in the last, you know, year or so as it becomes more relevant. And more prevalent, rather, like in the field. So there aren't a lot of Azure tools that are public. I think within the last 6 months, I can name three, mm. right, that are pretty prominent. And sure, like we can run those and check them out. But our perspective is different because we are internal, as opposed to someone who is externally trying to attack. So we always go with an assumed breach methodology. And it's a breach means that, okay, we are an attacker who is in the environment already. What can we do from that perspective? Mm-hmm.
I want to dig into that. But before we do, you made the comment, a C2, the letter C, the number 2, command and control. Maybe you could just say a little bit about that for folks who aren't familiar with that acronym.
So C2 systems is sort of a tool that an attacker will use in order to control a remote system. Right. So if I make you ask you to download this executable and you click it, right, or you open up this Word document, right, I may install a C2 on your device, right, to be able to control it remotely.
Okay. So then at that point, you're owned, you're pwned, and that's the assumption that you should just act as if everything that you're doing is on a machine that is already compromised.
Right. So we'll still do our initial recon phase for a lot of our operations where, you know, maybe we go to find a credential. But because we do mostly internal or all, I should say mostly, all of our operations are internal assessments with Microsoft Teams, we are already inside Microsoft from most angles. Whereas an attacker has to figure out a way how to get in first. We just assume that they've already gotten in and we have some level of access from that service that we're operating against in order mm-hmm. to do things.
Is that really important to just assume that you're owned already? Like, you know, the call is coming from inside the house. I hear that more and more in the last maybe 10 years of computer science, to just assume that they're already on a compromised system. And then the question is, once they're in, can you keep them in the foyer effectively, or can you keep them in the man cage at the front of the house? They've breached the front door, but once they're in the old days, we would assume that they have the keys to the castle and they can do everything. But in the modern times, it's like, well, they got into the moat, but they can't get out of the moat, and that's okay.
So the reason why assume breach is such a common methodology is because you can always assume that phishing is going to work, right? So that whole act of getting initial access is generally more of a time consuming matter because it's eventually going to work. Someone's going to open something or click something that they're not supposed to, and an attacker will have access. And so that's generally the mindset behind it, is that you are going to get initial access somehow. It's going to happen regardless of how many systems you try to have in place to prevent it. But when we go that route, we can just say, instead of having to waste our time, or not really invest the time into getting that initial access, it's more logical to assume that the access already exists.
Right. And then I understand that the access that they have should be limited, right? This is why we don't want to have super users. You have role-based access security. It's like, well, they got in, but they have read access to data that is limited in scope, as opposed to the old days of they have the SA password.
Right. So like in traditional red teaming, what you might normally get is like a user level account, right? And a lot of companies will ask, a lot of consulting companies will give like their organizations, target organizations, a computer or a laptop or something, and just say, put this in your network, and then give us the credentials for a user, just a normal user, and we'll see what we can do. For Azure, it's a little bit different because, or at least internally, it's because we don't, we already work at Microsoft. We're not trying to pretend to be, we don't need that level of access. So our assumed breach is always from our perspective. Oh, no, it's generally from our perspective as employees of Microsoft.
Interesting. So that was my next question. So it's like I'm imagining my job. I'm imagining I work on the red team. And I'm thinking to myself, how does this work? Do I pretend that I don't work for the company? Do I pretend that I work for the company and I'm just evil? You know, what's my role that I'm playing for the particular operation that I'm about to do?
I mean, sometimes it changes. So we may have different operations with different perspectives and requests that are asked of us. And so like the question may be, can an external person get directly to, this resource? And we have to sometimes answer that question. But generally speaking, we are coming from the inside, and we are assuming that if a user had, or if an attacker had somehow compromised CorpNet credentials, right, what could they do with this from the perspective of that particular service team?
Now you have a background in cyber operations. This has been your whole thing for a very long time. And I noticed that one of the things that you did was you worked on penetration testing and you got a certificate in ethical hacking. Why is that word ethical so important in front of hacking? What is ethical hacking?
Depends who you ask. So
I'm asking you, and that's why I want to understand.
All right. So that particular certificate, CEH, which is most commonly known as, it's considered to be one of the most baseline certificates you can get. And they try to stress it ethical. It's because the word hacker has been thrown around as a negative thing for so long that they'll put ethical in front of it in order to say, no, this, we are not teaching people how to do bad things for the purpose of doing bad things. We're teaching people the techniques and the tools that are used to do bad things in order to help your security team. So a lot of things will get advertised as ethical hacking just from the mindset of knowing that the average person is, when they hear hacker, always thinks like, anonymous or some bad entity doing something.
Okay. And is this where they hear that term white hat versus black hat?
Right. So like a lot of people aren't familiar with that, right? So if I said white hat, black hat, gray hat, there's like, what?
There's a gray hat? Tell me about the hats.
Right. So white hats are people who are considered to do hacking for legitimate purposes, right? They may work on a security team or some assessment team, and they are hacking something, an organization, because they have been authorized to do it, and they're trying to improve that security posture. Black hats are the people who do things for profit, right? Because they want to hack things because they're cool or whatever, and they have malicious intent generally. And then there's gray hats who are somewhere in the middle, and they may hack something because they want to, they're just curious about it. But then they say, hey, if you want they'll tell an organization, we've hacked this. But we'll fix it for you, quote, or we'll tell you how it was done if you pay us or something like that. Mm. It's there's a pretty thin line with what is known as gray hat hacking. Generally speaking, the majority of people will fall into white or black hat hacking. Mm-hmm.
No one wants to manage databases if they can avoid it. That's why MongoDB made MongoDB Atlas, a global cloud database service that runs on AWS, GCP, and Azure. You can deploy a fully managed MongoDB database in minutes with just a few clicks or a few API calls. MongoDB Atlas automates deployment, automates updates, handles scaling, and more so that you can focus on your application instead of taking care of your database. You can get started free at mongodb.com/atlas. Now, if you're already managing a MongoDB deployment, Atlas has a live migration service, so you can migrate it easily with minimal downtime and then get back to what matters. Stop managing your database and start using MongoDB Atlas. When, and forgive me for asking ignorant questions, that's kind of my superpower, is asking dumb questions. But as a developer who has a good understanding of programming, a good understanding of computer architecture, somewhat good understanding of networking, I'm not a hacker. I'm not a cybersecurity expert. I have only the basic understandings of ports and TCP/IP and blah, blah, blah. Are most cyber professionals, hackers or red team penetration testers like yourself, are you a superset? Are you all really great developers that can write really great code in Python and C and C++, or are there different levels? What's the skill set? Because I'm imagining that someone is listening to this and wondering what your job is. Do you do everything that a developer does, plus you have deep knowledge of security and network architecture? Like, it seems like you have to be really good at a lot of stuff to be able to do this job.
So that's a sensitive question for a lot of people in the community. A lot of people will tell you that you don't need to understand programming at all, right? In order to be a hacker, or I should say,
a penetration tester, security professional.
Yeah, a lot of people will say that, but it's generally accepted that you should have some programming knowledge. You should be able to read something, right? You should know if you're using a tool, what that tool does, and you should be able to read the code of that tool and say, I can modify this if I need to do something. It's a beneficial skill to have. A lot of people will say it's not required because pen testing and red teaming covers such a variety of fields that not every field needs to know how to do something like that. Right. So, for example, the ICS industry may have a different set of expectations for their skill sets might be than the traditional on-premises red teaming or pen testing. And even that skill set may be different from a lot of the cloud pen testing. So I wouldn't say that everyone's a subset of development or everyone has the skills that a developer has. Like I can't write front end frameworks like for my life, right? I'm terrible at it. If you ask me to look at something in .NET, I'll be like, okay, I guess. Like I know what I'm looking at because I'm familiar with like object oriented code, but generally speaking, there's no real requirement to be able to understand that level of developer lifecycle kind of deal. And the majority of things that they know, but it's highly recommended skill to have for sure.
Right. And I assume that there's different kinds of folks. I mean, there's network penetration testing, there's working on, various clouds, whether it be the Azure cloud or other third party clouds, which is different work than like local fuzz testing or trying to break out of a security sandbox within the context of an operating system, which are all different skills that may or may not require different levels of expertise.
For sure. So like you would expect that, and maybe this is from my experience saying this, but like a web app pen tester is going to have a completely different skill set than a network pen tester. And the web app pen tester may need to have a better knowledge of web app technologies, PHP, ASP, .NET Core, whatever it's called. See, I don't remember the name of it, right?
Yeah, but see, you don't need to because that's not the point, right?
Exactly. So everyone will have there's some level of quote development skill set as it pertains to their job, but there's no overall thing that says you need to have this, but you should be able to read stuff at a minimum. Like if you can't write something in a language, that's cool. I can't write in Java, but I can read through Java all day.
Interesting. So if you join the ASP.NET Core team, you've got the base of the pyramid of the stuff that you need to know, right? And then it would be expected that you would then apply the things that you already know and the professional skills that you have with an internal knowledge of ASP.NET, just as when you joined the Azure web team, I assume you weren't an Azure expert, you were a pen testing expert, and then you gained that knowledge.
Right. So like when I got this job, I had little to no knowledge of Azure. Like someone mentioned blob storage to me. I was like, what's that? Right. But my experience with the network side of things and like on-premises stuff kind of put me in a position where I can easily adjust to the things that were required for Azure red teaming.
That makes sense. And if I were going to go and work for WordPress and do your job, then I would be expected to become a WordPress expert.
Yeah, expert, but at least like a fairly good understanding, right? So in your example that you just gave with ASP.NET Core, right? If you were a developer who worked on that, and you wanted to move in the security portion, well, maybe you should have an understanding of like the do's and don'ts of programming in that language, right?
Right.
And being able to understand that if you do certain things, or if you configure things certain ways, here's how an attacker may be able to get to it. Mm-hmm.
So if someone wants to get your job and work in the space that you're working in, I noticed that you spent over a decade in the Navy. Did that set you up for success in this kind of work? Or is that a coincidence? Or is it just that the Navy has a very strong cryptology community?
I would definitely say that I would not be here if it were not for that time that I spent in the Navy. Before I joined the Navy, I was going to do I wanted to be like a video game composer. that was my goal, right?
That is a different job than you have right now.
Yeah.
You can still do both though, I guess.
Yeah, I could. but that was my goal coming out of high school, right? I didn't really have good grades, so I couldn't really go to college that easy. Mm-hmm. So I left to join the Navy, and then I was doing electronics, and I was like, I was going to get out at my 6-year mark. I was going to go to college and get like a degree in biometric engineering and something like that. Mm. And I was like, this opportunity came up to like move to like the cryptologic field. And I was like, all right, well, I'll give it a chance. And then if I don't like it, or if some other thing comes up, then I'll just get out in my 10-year mark. And that's what I did. So I moved over to cryptologic field for 4 years. And then I got out and I was like, I really want to be a pen tester or a red teamer. It took me that long to figure out what I really wanted to do, but for sure, I am glad that I am here.
When someone wants to get started, I see a lot of certificates, right? You said that there's like one of the certificates that I pointed out was a very basic certificate. It's like the base of the pyramid. Should people who are interested in security as a professional career collect all the certificates, or is there one that is more important than another, or one degree or one background? Like, how does one prove themselves and put it on a resume, other than saying, I'm the one that broke into whatever, you know?
That is also a matter of perspective. really like controversial topic. Some people will say you don't need any certs at all. And they'll talk about their experience coming out of high school and now being a prominent individual in the community with no degree and no certs. But everyone experiences varies. I know that I had a difficult time getting a job when I was getting out, even with all those certs listed. And it was a combination of things, really. But everyone's experience is different. So I would say that certs are generally seen as you might have the knowledge to do something. You might, right? But you have the potential to learn. So I would never like say don't get certs. I think everyone should have certs, particularly if you're trying to be like marketable. But a lot of people out there will say that none are required. And more power to them. If I were looking for a job now, I'd probably try to find certs that were relevant to that position just to make myself more competitive.
So it sounds like certs aren't the magic thing that one needs to get where it's like, oh yeah, well, you know, he's got the cert, so then we'll hire this person. It's not like that. I mean, the cert, it's something to study for. It's something to focus on. It's a goal. It might be a hurdle that they want you to get, but it's not necessarily the stamp book to fill.
Yeah. The biggest problem is that like HR departments will put out, we want these particular certs. And even if you are qualified without those certs, it may be difficult to get past that HR wall. But if you were to network with people, you know, directly and talk to people, then you probably have a better chance getting a position by networking with people than you would just having a certificate and trying to, you know, send in your resume.
Interesting. Is there a degree or a badge or a thing that one gets where you go, oh, wow, this person means business. They work for the Navy, or they got that cert, or they got that degree, or this is the school? Or is it really just a very diverse community with lots of different things that one could potentially do?
I would like to say that there isn't, but typically what you find is that people value OSCP to a degree, which is the Offensive Security Certified Professional. I remember what it's called.
Because there's like OSCE, OSCP, and OSWP. There's a bunch of those, but they're all offensive security something something.
Right. And people will take that as an indication of, you know, OSCP is really hard. If you are able to pass it, then it shows that you have a certain aptitude level and the ability to study for yourself and all that stuff. And so, like, that's generally how that certificate is viewed. But honestly, the other side of that is that OSCP is also sort of viewed as a beginner pen tester cert, right? Or beginner red team cert, because there's so much that it doesn't cover that's, you know, modern now, where a lot of companies are like moving to cloud environments, for example, right? That isn't covered. And so, like, while OSCP may be that thing that people are like, yeah, I'm going to get that and put that on my resume, it's not really indication of skill, but more of an indication of you were able to accomplish something by putting the time into it. That's how I view it. I know people would disagree with me. I can think of names on top of my head of people who would have issue with me saying that, but that's how I view certs like that.
Well, it seems reasonable. I think certs are definitely a point of contention because they can be used to really mean something and really say something, but to others, they just seem like an arbitrary hurdle that someone puts in front of someone in order to, you know, say, this is a thing we value. Here's a gatekeeping bit of motion that we're doing. But it sounds like there is a lot of value in some of them, and they are the standard. So it certainly can't hurt to have a cert.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So if you have the ability or the money to get one, I would for sure get one. There are some really expensive certs out there. But
That's a good point, too. Sometimes they're a racket because they cost so much.
Yeah, I would say that there are definitely some certs that have training that could be provided at alternatively. And a lot of those are seen as, you know, major certifications. But you can definitely get the knowledge for those certs at a cheaper price but you probably wouldn't get the recognition from like HR, for example.
Okay. All right. So let me pivot a little bit and ask a dumb question that I've always wanted to ask somebody. When you're watching, you know how, okay, as a programmer, when I watch a TV show and they do something super dumb where it's like four people on one keyboard, or like the person's got like a grid of nine monitors and he's like, you know, Minority Report or whatever. Have you ever watched a show and seen a real security moment and gone like, oh yeah, I felt like that once. That was exactly when I broke into whatever.
I can't say that I've seen, like, I haven't fully watched Dr. Robot, for example.
Mr. Robot.
Oh, Mr. Robot, yeah. I saw the first season, and I haven't watched the other seasons. Mm-hmm. Generally, what I'll see are things that, like, don't make sense. And like, I think that's just the nature of people. Whatever job you work, when you see something on TV that's not right or is not consistent with what you do, like, you kind of point that out more than, oh, man, this is actually, like, a legitimate thing that you can do. So when it comes to, like, security stuff, most people get it wrong. And that's because they want to keep things at such, like, either a dramatic feel or like a layman's terms that, you know, the actors don't know what they're saying. They're just repeating words. So they don't know, like, they may sound
somewhere. Yeah, it's like my wife's a nurse and she's just like, somebody's like, give me a CBC Chem 7 and dip a urine stat. And she's like, what are they even? That isn't even a thing. They just memorize that. They're, you know, and anyways, somebody always ends up stabbing somebody in the neck with a pen to do something. I don't know why they're choking or they can't breathe. So stab them in the neck with a pen.
Yeah.
I'm always ready to do that at any moment if anybody needs pen neck stabbing.
Oh, well, make sure to stay far away.
Yeah, watch out for me. Have you ever, let me ask you this. Have you ever had a moment where you did succeed, where you broke in, where you did something? You're just at the command line, it's whatever, and you like just put your hands up in the air. You're like, I got it. I did it. You had that moment. It may not necessarily be cinematic, but it was a hands up in the air pen testing moment.
Oh, yeah, that happened yesterday.
For real? Okay, give me that. That's our closing moment for the podcast. Tell me about that in generic terms.
I spent the last week doing things that I've never done before.
Nice.
And trying out a different approach to gaining access Mm-hmm. And when it worked, I just kind of sat there, like I got out of my seat and like, nobody else is in my apartment. Right. I got out of my seat. I was like, yeah.
I have totally done that. I have literally like stood up, turned around and be like, and then like no one else is around me and like no one cares that I did that.
There's absolutely those, especially when you've been working at it like all day and trying to figure things out. There's always that moment of yes. And then either the immediate reaction is, all right, let me keep going, or you know, let me go take a nap.
I'm imagining. I want to see the movie that about your life where you like jump up in the middle of the night in your apartment and you're like, "All right, and now for snacks." You know, I've just broken into the thing, and now I'm going to take a nap and check on the price of turnips.
It's literally what happens. Like I get a cupcake right afterwards. That was my
fantastic. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
For sure, appreciate you having me.
I've been chatting with Liron Gray from the Azure Red Team at Microsoft, and this has been another episode of Handsome Minutes. We'll see you again next week.